This is Audible.
Blackstone Audio presents The Brass Man, a Western story by Max Brand. This book is read by Traber Burns. Chapter 1. At 5:30 p.m., Weldon opened his eyes and remained for a time on the flat of his back, arms luxuriously outspread, while he studied the sagging ceiling above his head and breathed the warm, still air of the late afternoon. His thoughts were adrift. He could not for his life remember the nation, the state, or the town in which he found himself, until he had heaved up his head and glanced out the window. The first thing that he saw was the brutal front of Bull Mountain. He let his head sink back with a sigh of relief into the soft of the pillow. He was at San Trinidad then, but little wonder that he needed to be reminded of the locality. So many places had flicked under his eye of late, like cards under a thumb, like cards under a thumb. Closing his eyes again, he let their names and their faces slip through his mind, like water through a flume. And then he smiled. To lie with vacant mind, to think busily, passively, to recollect, were all pleasant to Weldon. He could enjoy life for its own sake, unpointed, unmoralized, and all the functions of life were sweet to him. In digestion he could have rivaled a goat, and in nerves a fat-sided bull, calm lord of the pasture. To eat, to sleep, even to breathe, were delightful occupations for Weldon. So he was in no haste now to rise. To another the heat in that little whitewashed chamber would have been as oppressive as a closed oven, but Weldon reveled in its very intensity, which relaxed muscles and brain. But eventually hunger began to grow on him. He stretched out his hand to the door and threw it open. "Food!" called Weldon, and the echo roared down the hall. He closed his eyes again and waited. At length he heard the whispering of skirts. A Mexican chambermaid tapped at the open door, entered. Chambermaids are not bashful as a rule, but he could feel the timidity of this one in her pausing steps as she came in.
"Señor?"
"No speak English," invited Weldon.
"No, señor. Mi padre..."
"Let your father be," Weldon said, in very fair Spanish. He opened his eyes at last and looked up to her. She was almost unreasonably pretty. The thought of food dropped from the mind of Weldon. What would the señor have? "One thing at a time," Weldon said, and continued to survey her, not with rude inquiry, almost as he would look at a charming picture. Then he sang softly, just above his breath, "Eyes like the evening and throat like the dawn." She blushed, and Weldon smiled kindly upon her. Was the señor hungry? He was. What would he have? Anything in the house that was good. There were frijoles then, of course. Equally, of course, there were tortillas. In all of Mexico there were no tortillas more excellent than the thin, white wafers that her mother patted out with her own authentic hands. There was some flesh of kid ready for cooking. Cut small and turned on many little spits, it could be roasted and ready in a few minutes. As for a bath, two strong mozos would carry up the water in buckets, and he could have the whole of the tin tub in the adjoining room filled. It would be almost enough to swim in. She left. The voice of Weldon pursued her gently. "Eyes like the evening and throat like the dawn." He heard her hesitate in the hall, and then go on more slowly, so he sat up with a little chuckle. "San Trinidad," murmured Weldon. "I like you fine." Afterward he stood in the tin tub in the adjoining room, while the two admiring and awe-stricken mozos poured bucket after bucket of cold water over his great white shoulders, over his quivering muscles. When he had rubbed himself dry and dressed, he descended to the patio of the hotel, with his spurs clinking softly at every step. Golden spurs, how they flashed and glimmered as he crossed the open space into the sun. It was a blasting, blazing heat. It turned the red roofs into red flame. It turned the white walls into white fire. But Weldon did not avoid it. He stood still in the center of the patio, and taking off his sombrero, he allowed the hand of the sun to be laid upon him with all its force. From the shadows of a vine-draped corner, a little man with a thin brown face said almost peevishly in English, "Now you better watch yourself, son. You'll be collecting sunstroke." "Thanks," said Weldon, "but I need a sunbath." He strolled over to one of the little tables that stood within the colonnade, and there he lolled in a chair that creaked under his weight, but managed to sustain it. "It kills germs," said Weldon. He had a way of doing that, completing a sentence or a speech in detached sections. He regarded the little man with his characteristic smile, genial, twinkling, a little stupid, as though he included everyone among the good things of life. Steaming frijoles wrapped in thin gray tortillas were brought to him. He began to eat, unhurryingly, vastly. The little man with the thin brown face behind his Mexican cigar raised his brows at this heap of disappearing food. Then he shifted a little in his chair, and he twitched the shoulder nearest to Weldon nervously. The frijoles and the tortillas disappeared. Then came more tortillas, and a great dish of roasted kid chopped into square chunks and toasted brown before an open fire. There was a dish of red sauce also. Into this Weldon dipped each bit of meat. He was still unhurried, but the food began to disappear as though in a fire. He never crammed his mouth. It simply seemed capable of accommodating any given amount with ease. The little man could not help but watch. Against his will, his head was drawn over his shoulders to stare. He kept snapping head and eyes to the front as though he were shaking off flies. He looked far off and drummed his thin fingertips rapidly on the top of his table, but still his eyes were drawn back to the meal that Weldon was making. Weldon raised a special bit on the end of his knife. It was charred a trifle at the edges. The rest was thickly encrusted with brown. The red sauce dripped from it. "Have some," invited Weldon. The little man snapped around in his chair. "Young man," he said, "am I old enough to tell you something?" "Advice?" murmured Weldon. "The man that won't take free advice, he'll have to pay high for repentance." "Well," began the other. "Advice?" reiterated Weldon. "Advice is experience, done in shorthand." "It is," said the other. "And therefore," the slow-speaking Weldon went on, "good advice is better than an eye in the hand." "Of course it is, young man, and I want to tell you, him that won't be advised," went on Weldon in his soft and genial voice, "can't be helped." "Go on, go on, go on," said the other peevishly. "Finish up all that you've got to say on the subject. I can wait, I can wait." "I'd take advice from any man, as if he was my father," said Weldon. "Advice is better than whipping, and they say that the worst men may give the best advice." He smiled kindly upon the other. "Are you going to have some of this roast kid with me?" The little man snapped his fingers. He was almost in a rage. "No," he cried, "I'm not going to have any of it. And another thing, that red sauce, you know what that is?" Weldon hesitated, and then with his impervious good nature he said, "Tastes like boiled down fire, partner. What might you think about it?" The little man opened his eyes. He had a thin beard that gave a pointed, old-fashioned, almost sinister look to his face. The beard now quivered as he paused for words. "Then why in heaven's name do you eat it? Makes my tongue raw just to watch you," he declared. "It makes the lining of my innards curl up and shrivel off in chunks." Weldon placed the debated morsel in his mouth, yet he spoke around it with no seeming difficulty. "Does it now?" he said. "I'll tell you how it appears to me. Pretty near everything is good, if you take it the right way. And if not—" "Hello," said the other. Christian Science? Why not? Suggested Weldon. It's true that all of them that carry long knives ain't cooks, but you gotta teach a cook in his kitchen, not at the dining table, so I aim to take what I get. The little man shuddered. He supported his head with both hands. His lips quivered around the cigar. Rapid jets of smoke panted forth before his face, and through the smoke his eyes blinked at Weldon. "When I think of what the inside of your stomach must be like," he commented, sighing. "Never had a stomachache in my life," said Weldon, and he finished off both meat and sauce by rolling the last chunk of roasted flesh in the red liquid, covering it so thickly that he had to keep the morsel spinning on the way to his lips to retain the covering sauce. The little man refused to see this dreadful concoction swallowed. He actually covered his eyes with both hands, but he could not help lowering those hands cautiously, just in time to see the act of swallowing performed. He made a soft, choking sound, left his chair, took a few hurried paces back and forth, and then sat down again with a jar, and began to stare openly at Weldon. Chapter 2 The chambermaid, she seemed the servant of all work, stood before Weldon. She picked up the stack of empty dishes, but her wonder made her open-mouthed. She looked under the table. She glanced around the patio, as though in search of a stray dog that could have had a portion of this huge meal. She even eyed the pockets of Weldon with some suspicion. He turned them inside out. At that, she put up her pretty hands and laughed.
"But no, signor, only it is wonderful."
"There's something else to come," said Weldon.
"And that, signor?"
"You have beer?"
"Yes, signor."
"You keep it in your cellar?"
"Yes, signor."
"And is the cellar cool?"
"It drips with coolness. It is like ice. Even thinking about it makes one shiver."
"Go down there and shiver a little for my sake," said Weldon. "Go down there and put your hands on the bottles until you find the one with the most chill in it. Bring that back to me, and bring three or four more bottles along with you." She went away. "Man, man," murmured the stranger, "aren't you burning up? Isn't there smoke in your throat and sparks in your eyes?" Weldon looked upon him with perfect calm and rolled a cigarette with one hand. There was no haste in that gesture, and yet one twist of the fingers seemed to level the tobacco, fold in the paper edge, and complete the rolling. Weldon brushed the loose flap of the thin brown paper across the tip of his tongue. He lit a match, and it seemed to the stranger that half the length of the cigarette was drawn into those big lungs in a single breath. A raw, ugly stub of red cinders thrust itself out at the end of the cigarette, the paper curling back rapidly at its base. "By heck," said the man, moistening his own dry lips and nervously tossing his cigar away. "I think you'll choke, and I almost hope that you do." "Friend," said Weldon, and as he began to speak, the smoke commenced to issue from his lips in curls and wisps and thin blue-white puffs, and then in great gushing torrents and clouds. "I'm getting ready for a perfect minute. I'm putting the top on the mountain. Everything has got to be perfect. And then... The girl appeared loaded with bottles. She set them on the table, six, side by side. "Drink quickly," said the little stranger, fidgeting again in his chair. I want to hear that beer hiss as it goes down." "Patience, patience," murmured Weldon. "Patience makes perfect. Which is the coldest bottle, my dear?"
"These, signor. These, I think."
"But we must know," said Weldon. "Otherwise, there'd be a perfect opportunity not perfectly used. That would be a shame, I'd say. How about you, partner? Do you drink with me?" "Drink beer? That thin, bitter stuff?" said the little man with violence. "I wouldn't taste it for thousands of dollars." "Wouldn't you now?" Weldon said. "Every man has got to ride his own trail. But when I think... And here he opened the bottle, pulling off the clamped metal cap with his unaided fingertips, of what this bottle of beer is going to mean to me.
Oh, drink it, will you? The little stranger snapped. It gets on my nerves. Your throat will be raw. It must be raw now. It's pickled as if it had been soaked in lye.
To you, my beautiful, Weldon said to the girl. She clasped her hands and bowed to him. To you, to your eyes, to your lips, to your heart. He tipped the bottle. The amber liquid gurgled. The little man stared, stirred, half rose from his chair.
Ah, said Weldon, and set down the empty bottle.
My word, said the little man.
And now, Weldon said, here's to make perfect more perfect. Here's to the cook, bless her, and here's to the sauce that she served to me.
The second bottle followed the first with equal speed, and when a single draught had emptied it, Weldon laid hold on a third.
"Man, man!" cried the little stranger in some uneasiness. "You'll burst yourself wide open!"
"You see me drink, but you don't see my thirst," Weldon answered mildly. "I had inside of me a desert of sand, under a sun at noon. Even the lizards were afraid to leave the shadows, and the cactus shriveled and began to smoke, and the buzzards staggered in the open air, and the bald-headed eagle put his head under his wing.
Oh, darn your desert!" snapped the other.
"But I've flooded the outer edges of that desert, and now there's only one dry place right in the center, which I'm going to cover this time, if my aim is good. To you, beautiful, and the cook, and the motherland that bore the pair of you." The third bottle went down like the other two. Weldon leaned back in his chair and rolled another cigarette.
"And you ain't in any pain, I suppose," snarled the other.
"No, Mr. Dickinson," Weldon said, "not a mite. Will you smoke with me?" Dickinson snapped his fingers, not once, but two or three times, like the rapid popping of crackers on the 4th of July.
"You knew me all the time," he said. "By heck, you knew me all the time."
"Why, everybody knows you," Weldon smiled. "Everybody knows Jim Dickinson. Everybody admires him. Everybody wants to see him."
"Oh, shut up, Weldon," said Dickinson.
He took out another cigar, lit the wrong end of it, and struggled vainly to make it go. He was too excited to notice his mistake.
"How did you come?" asked Dickinson.
"All kinds of ways, partly by horse, and partly by foot, and partly by train."
"I don't believe it," said Dickinson. "I have had every train searched, every train this side of—"
"Did you have your men look carefully at the engineers?" asked Weldon.
"Huh? What?" Dickinson cried. "Damnation! I don't believe it! What did you do with the man you displaced, then?"
"I put him to sleep in the tender."
Dickinson groaned. "Well, well, well," he said, "and here you are. I don't believe it. I don't believe my eyes."
"Why'd you come here, then, if you didn't expect me to get through?"
"I came on the odd chance, the thousandth chance. I wasn't overlooking anything."
"Well," Weldon said, "so we meet at last. In Mexico." The other writhed. "When you have a chance," said Weldon, "look over to the entrance to the patio. There's a picture walking in. Spanish picture. Maybe Italian. Maybe a dash of French. Ain't she a sweetheart, Dickinson?"
"Why don't you talk English?" asked the other with irritation. "Why do you always use that hodgepodge of range slang and nonsense when you know better?"
"Talking or walking," said Weldon, "I always aim to take the shortest cut." He let his gaze drift past the other. At the patio entrance was a long gray automobile, low of line, mighty of hood. The throbbing of the engine really could not be heard. There was a mere pulse in the air.
"That's a He-Man's car," said Weldon, "and look what come out from under the wheel of it."
It was a girl,
now slipping out of her duster and tossing it into the abandoned seat. She came across the courtyard with a light, rapid step, paused, glanced over the upper windows, and then entered the hotel.
"Eyes like the evening and throat like the dawn," Weldon sang gently. And then, letting a great voice ring and boom like thunder, he repeated the line.
"You know her, do you?" asked Dickinson. "You're sending her a signal, are you? Mixed up in that business, too, eh?" He nodded his head vigorously and glared again at his younger companion.
"Know her?" said Weldon. "At least I'll never forget her. Did you see her eyes?"
"I've seen her eyes," snarled Dickinson. "Like the evening? Like midnight, I'd say, with a murder thrown in for salt. You don't know her name?"
"No idea of it."
"That's Francesca LaGuardia."
"Italian, eh?"
"I don't know, and I don't care. Only how I'd like to jail her."
"Is she crooked, Dickinson?"
"Crooked!" exclaimed Dickinson. "Crooked!" He could only repeat the word. Further definition choked him.
"I've seen them east," said Weldon, "and I've seen them west, but I never seen the mate of her."
"That's college grammar, I suppose," the irritable little man suggested.
"It's postgraduate grammar," Weldon said, always with his smile.
"Well," snapped Dickinson, "I might as well tell you. They wired to me last night. Baxter is dead."
"And now they'll want to hang me, of course?"
"They ought to, of course," Dickinson said with a grumble. "But that fool Baxter, just before he went out, confessed that it had been a frame to get you, that you'd simply fought your way out of it. And I suppose I gotta tell you that you're a free man to go where you please again."
Chapter 3 To this intelligence, Weldon responded by tilting up his head and watching for a long moment the swaying tendrils of the vine that hung like a suspended green shower before them.
"What a lucky thing," he said, "that Baxter didn't confess at once."
"Lucky!" cried angry Dickinson. "Lucky!"
Suddenly his attitude changed. He slipped lower in his chair.
"Go on and explain that, Weldon."
"Why, man, then I never should have seen San Trinidad this trip. I never should have sat here and eaten roast kid and drunk beer and talked to the great Dickinson."
He waved a big hand and smiled again, genially but a little blankly.
Dickinson stood up. All his movements were done with a jump. He leaned his shoulder against a thick adobe pillar and looked at the other.
"How old are you, Weldon?"
"Just a few years younger than you think."
"By heck, young man! There's times when I think you're not out of swaddling clothes."
Already the second cigarette was gone. The third was made and lit.
"You'll ruin your lungs," said Dickinson.
Weldon blew to the ceiling a great cloud of white. "Never bother me," he said. The dyspeptic face of Dickinson wrinkled fiercely. He smoothed it with his hand again.
"I don't suppose so. I don't suppose so," he said. "A man of brass, hammered brass. Never a headache or a stomachache or a chill or a fever in your life?"
"Never," Weldon confirmed, nodding.
"Why do you do it?" asked Dickinson savagely. "Why? Why?"
"Drink beer?" asked Weldon.
"You know what I mean. Don't dodge around corners when I'm talking to you. Don't try any smart shifts and tricks with me, young man."
Big Weldon submitted to this bullying with perfect calm. His eyes were like the eyes of a well-fed ox as they rested upon the face of his companion. "For one thing, I hate work," he admitted.
"Just want to be a weight and a drain on society, eh?"
Dickinson said in the same savage manner. He continued, expanding on his thought.
"It's not right or fair. We have enough trouble with the normal criminal classes. Half-wits, only shrewd to do wrong, undernourished brains, pathological cases that ought to be behind hospital walls, not behind bars, ignorant Latins and Orientals, dope fiends, drunkards, weak wits of all kinds. We have our share of trouble with those people. A criminal is crazy. I've always said so. I've always known so. But you're not crazy, Weldon. You have a good brain. That brain was well-trained. Cost thousands to equip you mentally. What do you do with that equipment? Chuck it away. Worse than that. It's like using a fine battleship for petty, sneaking piracy. Why, if you're going to be a criminal, why don't you do something big? Why don't you smash the Bank of England, or rip the heart out of the United States Mint, or burgle Wall Street, or something like that?
I never was inspired, Weldon responded, his faint smile returning. You're putting good ideas in my head.
Instead of that, why, you're like a bunch of tumbleweed, rolling where the wind blows you. Down to Mexico, up to Canada, a card game here, a gunfight there, knife battle yonder. And why? What do you gain? What do you put in the bank?
I live, Weldon said in mild answer. Dickinson pointed a trembling, bony forefinger at him.
You've got no self-respect, he declared.
Because, Weldon said, no one ever takes me seriously. His glance wandered toward the upper range of windows that looked over the patio. A pair of shutters was being folded back, but afterward the window remained shut. Who should want to let in the light and not the air at this time of day? But the sun was falling deeper to the west. The sting was lost from its rays. Rich, sleepy warmth exhaled from the ground, from the walls, and the golden languor overspread the skies.
"Why don't people take you seriously?"
"There's my name," Weldon replied.
"A good name. Why not? Used to be an honest name," said Dickinson, "until you began to roll it in the dust." He added with his usual snap, "Lorimer Everett Weldon. What can be wrong with that name?"
"Don't you see? The initials spell a word. Lou. Well, when a man is called Lou, you can't take him seriously, can you?"
"Ah, nonsense. You have to get your smile out of everything. You begin with yourself, and you never stop laughing."
"Seriously?"
"You're called other things than Lou."
"Yes. Big Boy, Blondie, the Big Kid.
Serious names, Dickinson?"
"I think not. The world takes me easily. I take the world easily. That's all."
"Well, well, well," said Dickinson. "And what do you want out of life?"
"The thing that lies around the corner."
"What lies around the corner?"
"I don't know," Weldon said.
"What?"
"If I knew, I wouldn't want it."
Dickinson blew out a sharp whistle of disgust, impatience, and of understanding also. He sat down suddenly. The chair jarred and shook with his suddenness.
"I could use you," he said slowly. "I could use you, boy."
"Hunting crooks?" asked Weldon.
"I could use you," Dickinson sighed, and made no other answer.
"Who is the beautiful child with the big gray car?" asked Weldon.
"What child?" snapped the other. "Child?"
"Francesca LaGuardia, you called her."
"Child?" Dickinson repeated. "Rather a cold-blooded hawk. Child? There's no child in her. Some women never are young. She was grown up when she was born."
"Like Athena," said Weldon.
"Like what?"
"Nothing. She's a lovely thing."
"All hellcats are lovely."
The glance of Weldon strayed toward the recently unshuttered window. The glass of that window was of the worst quality, rolled unevenly, filled with waves, so that the highlights were streaked across its surface irregularly. Nevertheless, behind the glass in the deep darkness of the chamber, he saw a form. It looked like a daylight ghost.
"I've only seen her face. Perfect face. Perfect. Perfect," Weldon sighed.
"I've seen her hands, too," said Dickinson, "and I've seen her handiwork."
"Exquisite hands," Weldon commented,
luxuriously closing his eyes and dreaming aloud. Slender, pink-tipped fingers, soft and strong, easily flowing lines, and a round, small wrist, with a blue vein shining through crystal.
"Oh, shut up!" Dickinson ordered. "It makes me ache to hear you talk like that."
"I was thinking aloud," said Weldon.
"That's why women are the worst criminals," Dickinson said. "They carry their shield with them. A man, honest or crooked, is a thing without a face or a feature. It's the heart and soul that makes a man. A woman's two-thirds flesh and one-third mind, and when that mind is bad, it still can dodge behind the body. Men prefer a woman to be a little bad. It's sauce to the dish. You, Weldon, you'd prefer 'em that way."
"Yes," Weldon said thoughtfully. "A little sainted, or a little the reverse. No doubt you're right. But I never thought of it before. You cut at once to the quick of things, Dickinson." Like a fish rising through dark water, the form behind the window glimmered closer to the glass. Like a fish sinking again, it receded, and was blotted out completely by the winking glass surface and the thick shadows inside. Weldon stood up. "Gonna take a walk," he announced.
"Where?" asked the little Dickinson.
"I don't know. Come along." The two strolled across the patio. Rather, Weldon strolled, and Dickinson walked jerkily beside him, hurrying ahead, half-turning and waiting for the other to catch up, like a child leading a great mastiff on a leash. At the entrance to the patio, they paused beside the big, long, low gray car. It had four seats, fitted with armrests. A heavy luggage carrier was fastened on behind. The rear seats were set inside the rear axle, so that one could be sure of not too much lurch and pitch in taking a corner fast. Weldon leaned thoughtfully on the front door.
80 still, he said. "This baby was hot a while ago."
80 still, says the thermometer.
"She never cuts down below 60, said Dickinson. "That's her idea of a slow pleasure spin. Ordinarily, she prefers something round 90 and 100.
100, Weldon repeated. "That's steppin'." He opened the hood and looked at the engine. "Nice little old straight 8, he said.
"No name of a maker, though," snapped Dickinson. "No name of a maker anywhere."
"It's Italian, old son," Weldon said, "and it's a special. No wonder she'll do 100. And then a little bit more, I make my guess. A little bit more.
Does she need 100, Dickinson?"
"Does a bird need wings?" retorted the man of the law bitterly. "And even 100 ain't going to be enough for her one day."
He knocked a small fist against his breast. His eyes were so fierce that Weldon had a sudden picture of a little man furnished with vast condor wings, splitting the air at dazzling speed, and far beneath, an automobile glistening and streaming along a winding road.
"You haven't told me what she does," Weldon said. "Do you mind telling?"
"If I knew," said the other, "I wouldn't mind telling. I'd even put it in the papers, if I knew. I only know a few of the footnotes about her. But would any woman or man want with a car like this on the border, unless he was a millionaire and a speed fool?"
"Smuggling?" Weldon offered.
"Wonderful brain," sneered Dickinson.
His bright eyes fastened on the face of Weldon and roved as he read.
"Guess I'll ramble along," said Weldon.
"Where, man? Where is there to walk in a town like this?"
"Oh, just around the corner."
"Oh, you be damned!" Dickinson snapped and turned upon his heel. There was a whisper in the air. The girl was coming back toward the car.
"Good evening, Mr. Dickinson," she said.
He made no pretense of cordiality. He glared back at her in hatred, just pointed and sharpened by a touch of curiosity.
"Humph!" he said.
It made no difference to her or to her smile. Weldon, still lingering, opened the door for her, and she thanked him with the most direct, the friendliest of smiles. She settled herself at the wheel, pressed a lever, and pushed back the sliding seat an inch.
"You know cars?" she said to Weldon, still with that friendly smile.
He closed the door without a click, only a smooth, powerful pressure of his hand.
"Now and then I know them a little," he said.
"You'd like this."
"I would," he agreed.
To take his eyes from her was like taking his hand from a crown of rubies. He stepped back and raised his hat. The engine whirred, the big car whined in first, moved off, and then as the gears shifted without a jar into second, it gathered momentum and swerved around the corner. Thereafter, he heard the faint, thrilling whisper of high speed and the pulse and throb of the great motor living in the air. He replaced the hat. Opposite him, an old woman was squatted in her doorway, patting out wet tortillas for the evening meal. She did not look at her handiwork, but she grinned broadly at him. He crossed the street and leaned a hand against the side of the house.
"You smile at me, mother?"
Her fat face wrinkled with silent laughter.
"Why not, senor?"
"Of course, there's no reason."
She raised her hand, the palm of it glistening from the wet cornmeal she had been working.
"Yesterday I was a beautiful young creature, too. I was a fool, though," she added after a brief pause. "But why so foolish? This is where a pretty face takes you."
She began to pat the tortillas again.
Weldon walked on around the corner.
Chapter 4 Around the corner he found Miguel Cabrera's. It was a twilight house. In the day, neither heat nor light could enter. In the night, the small, unshaded electric lights let one see the faces of the cards and the spots on the dice, and that was all. Only at the roulette wheels there were extra flares of illumination. But even there the light constantly altered, for the current was not stable, and the bulbs flared brilliant white or sank to dull yellow by turns, which gave the entire chamber an unreal appearance. Nothing could be really cool in San Trinidad. Every opening of the street door let in a moist flood of warmth. But there were big electric fans purring like cats here and there, casting forth gales as the fans swung slowly to and fro, with human hesitancies and resumptions of the rhythm. For a long time, Weldon did not play. Every day to him had its own taste. Now he tasted San Trinidad, slowly, carefully. And like a taster of wine, he did not attempt to gulp it down, on trust. He had a glass of Mexican brandy before him, that pale fire that eats the brain. But to Weldon it was just right. Its odd green taste finished off the picture his eyes beheld. It was not so much taste in his mouth as a flavor in his brain. He was stepping deeper and deeper into San Trinidad. He was walking around the corner. A boy came by his corner table, showering wet bran and wood shavings upon the floor. Another followed to sweep it up. They would keep up this work all the evening. It cooled the air, and that was its importance, rather than an attempt at cleanliness. Miguel Cabrera's gathered its crowd. It was not a very large crowd, but it was spending money. There is always money to spend in the Mexican towns near the American border. Most of those present were Mexicans of the middle class. There were not a few somber-faced peons, too. And there was a liberal sprinkling of Americans here, also. One could tell them by their voices. They were all well-behaved. They spoke very quietly, like men accustomed to win and lose money. But they spoke with a harsh monotony of sound, coming up from deep within and resounding through the nose. As for the Mexicans, there was a song in their throat. They talked rapidly but sweetly. It was like the chatter of women at an afternoon tea, but more subdued, more somber. so Weldon drank in his brandy and the scene, and digested it, and was more and more pleased. He had seen such places before, many of them. But to Weldon, every door of life opened upon a new room, and every moment was the crossing of a world. He never accused existence of dullness. He accused himself. The roulette wheels were occupying most of the attention on this night. Every now and then the crowd around one of them would leave the wheel and flow back to the long bar that glimmered sedately at the rear of the room. Someone had made a big winning. Then the crowd flowed back. Bets were doubled. The wheel recouped its loss and grew fat again. "You're Weldon?"
"My name is Cunningham. May I sit down with you a moment?"
"Certainly," said Weldon.
The newcomer raised his hand. A waiter was conjured out of shadows. "Beer, if you please." The waiter vanished. "I can't do that, you know," Cunningham said, pointing to the glass of brandy. "Not in this weather." He passed a handkerchief across his forehead. He was very hot. He wore a suit of linen. Where the coat bound his strong shoulders, there were wet marks. It was a fine forehead that he showed. A highlight gleamed on a knob above either eye. Surely this man was not a fool. He was about 35, with a brown, rugged, honest face, and extremely steady eyes.
"You don't know me?"
"I don't," said Weldon.
"Smoke?"
"I'll smoke my own."
He took out a small silver box and rolled a cigarette with long shredded tobacco. When he lit it, the faint, sweet aroma of Turkish tobacco was in the air.
"I know about you, of course," said Cunningham.
Weldon waited. He was one of those rare men who can be comfortably silent. There was always that genial half-smile on his lips and in his kindly eyes, uncritical but observant.
"And so I'll ask you first if you're doing anything."
"Not a thing."
"Do you want to work?"
"I never do."
"I understand, of course. Not really work."
"Well," said Weldon, "I love to be tempted, and I love to fail."
Cunningham smiled. He was a handsome fellow when he smiled in this fashion, and his appreciative eyes ran over Weldon, hands, shoulders, neck, and jaw. "I run liquor, Chinamen, opium, and such stuff north across the river. I run cash, guns, ammunition, and a few luxuries like that south across the river. That's my business."
He spoke without any secretive lowering of his voice. The approaching waiter was almost sure to have heard the last part of the speech, Weldon thought.
"It's interesting work," said Cunningham, taking up his glass of beer and surrounding its coldness with both hands. "I think you would like it."
"In part, perhaps," said Weldon.
"Of course," said Cunningham. "I wouldn't ask you to work on the opium and dope."
"Thanks," said Weldon.
"But the Chinaman and the liquor."
"Honest liquor and honest Chinaman?" Weldon smiled.
"The liquor is honest," qualified Cunningham.
"I don't know," murmured Weldon. Cunningham waited. After a moment, when there was no clearing of the thought in Weldon's eyes, he said,
"I'd like to have you understand that the money would be worthwhile. We paid different sorts of prices, not very much to the rank and file. For the chiefs who handle the greatest dangers, money is hardly any object."
Then he explained, "Of course, you would start at the top."
"With the dangers," again Weldon smiled.
"Naturally, that's what you want, and that's why we want you, too."
"Will you wait a few minutes?"
"A few hours for you, Weldon."
"I have $1,500. Are these games straight?"
"Cabrero is crooked. The games may be straight."
"Very well. Coming along?"
"I do my gambling in another way," Cunningham said with a smile, and Weldon left him at the table.
Chapter 5
Weldon, going toward the nearest roulette table, passed one of the boys who constantly swept the floor of the gaming hall.
He beckoned to the youngster and placed a broad-faced silver peso in his grimy palm. "There is still a man in my table, American. If he leaves that table, watch where he goes. Follow. Come back to tell me." The boy did not glance toward the table. There was simply a steely little glitter in his eyes, and he nodded, full of his work. Weldon went on toward the table. He watched only a moment, placed 500 on the red, won, and put the doubled stake on the black. He won again. He placed the total on odd, and once more he had doubled his stake. He had $5,000 in place of $1,500, and this had been won in the course of a very few moments. The other gamblers were watching him like hawks. They were preparing to follow his guidance, for a man whose luck is coming in is like a ship coming into port. It should be followed by all hungry birds of the air. He began to play single numbers, thrice on the 9, thrice on the 7, thrice on the 27. The money was swallowed again by the machine, $100 at a time. The croupier, his face like yellow wax, emotionless as a mummy, watched and chanted in a droning voice. Those who followed the play of Weldon were already broke or discouraged by 9 straight losses. He lost $4,000 in a breath. He lost another $1,000. Then the 18 won for him. On that stroke, $3,500 back, and the croupier raised his dull, flameless eyes and looked at him steadily for half a second as the wheel spun once more. A bet on the red, $1,000. Black won. Another $1,000 on the red. Black won. Then $1,000 on the black, and red won. Another $1,000 on the black, and red won again. There was a tug at Weldon's arm. He stepped back. The whisper of the boy who he had hired as a spy barely reached his ear, and no other.
"A break,"
whispered the lad. Weldon smiled kindly down at him. "I thought so," he said. "And the gentleman?" For the table where he had sat was now empty.
"He was out the side door into the alley. I followed. He stood in the gutter and smoked a cigarette. Very soon a señorita passed. She had a heavy mantilla over her head. She said 3 words in English. The señor said 3 words in English, and she went in. Then he came back. Soon he will be at the table."
At that moment, Cunningham reseated himself at the empty table. The boy disappeared in the crowd with an extra peso weighing down his pocket. Weldon put his last $100 on odd, and smiled as he saw it win, and then doubled on the red. If there was a break on this machine, they at least intended that he should keep a little money in his pocket. Most of his thoughts were back at the table with Cunningham, or out yonder in the street, where the señorita in the heavy mantilla had passed by and spoken words in English. There were many American men in this town. There were few or no American women. He would have given a great deal to have heard the voice of that woman, and he would have wagered more than he had lost at roulette that it was the same voice in which the girl at the wheel of the gray automobile had spoken to him that evening, a rich voice, rather deep, contralto, with the ring of a clear bell in it. He put $100 on number 17. It was lost. He put another $100 on number 7. The wheel spun. The ball wavered back and forth from 10 to 4. Would it drop in 7? Suddenly, the wheel slowed. The ball dropped in 9. With a soft hiss, the wheel still revolved.
9 black.
"My friend," said Weldon. He had his proof now. There was a break in that wheel, and the croupier had worked it a little awkwardly in this instance. A roulette wheel has the even movement of a planet. It dies softly, gradually. There is no sudden diminution in its pace, such as that alteration that his keen eye had noted.
"The señor speaks to me?"
said the croupier. He smiled on Weldon, a pretended pity softening his eyes.
I speak to you. Step here with me.
1,000 pities. I may not leave my place. It never is so in Cabreros.
The hand of Weldon made a little gesture as of surrender, but coming close to the croupier, it fastened on his shoulder. He was lifted from his little platform to the floor.
"Your wheel carries a brake, friend," said Weldon.
"Dios!" said the croupier.
It was as though a gun had been presented to his head. He writhed, and with his right hand he made an upward stroke at Weldon's body. It was a quick rather than a strong movement, but one does not need great strength to drive a pin-pointed dagger through a man's heart. Weldon caught that armed hand in mid-air. He turned it with a jerk. There was the grinding sound of a bone breaking. The croupier cried out. The knife tingled on the floor like a little silver bell. Weldon stood on the platform where the croupier had been. The poor man was staggering toward the wall, one arm dangling, ruined, the other stretched before him as though he fumbled his way through the dark.
"Friends, gentlemen, this machine is not honest," said Weldon. "There is a break in it. I propose to examine it and see if I can find the break. I hope to have your help."
Help? The crowd had scattered backward from him, as little waves roll away from a dropped stone in a pool. Voices began to shout. 9/10 of the lights were snapped out. Only a dim twilight remained, and that dimness showed the crowd of gamblers making for the doors. Weldon took hold of the wheel and its stand and pulled upward. It was firm. He bent his knees and pulled again. The wood parted like thick paper with a screeching sound, and he laid the machine and its pedestal upon one side. Then he saw that while the crowd flowed outward like water, there were certain men who had not moved. They remained fixed while the torrent flowed around them. Outside in the street, the noise of the panic crashed and roared, and voices shrilled with excitement and fear. But these men who had remained now began to converge on Weldon. There were 6 or 7 of them, walking cautiously toward him, and every man was armed. He dropped on his knees behind the table and opened the stem of the wheel as a boy opens an orange. It was a neat little contrivance, that brake. It would work as delicately as the needle of a seamstress. A clumsy fellow, the croupier, to have put it on with such sudden violence. But perhaps he had grim orders to lose no more money at that table. In truth, such things will happen at a gambling house. Weldon picked out the important working parts of the brake and dropped them in his pocket. Then he looked about him once more. The men were drawing to a rapid focus around him. He crossed his arms and swept his hands up. They came from beneath his armpits, each weighted with a long-barreled, old-fashioned, heavy Colt, single action. The sights and the triggers filed away, the hammers under his thumbs.
"I want no trouble," Weldon said clearly in Spanish.
"Gringo beast," said one of the men.
His voice had a sob of rage in it, and he fired point-blank. Weldon felt a plucking at his shoulder, as though someone had touched him there to draw his attention. He pitched face downward on the platform beneath the next table.
"He is mine!"
cried a wildly exultant voice. But there lay Weldon, smiling happily in the twilight, his guns extended, perfectly steady because of the butts being on the floor. He began to fire at the men's legs, between the knee and the hip. Unless a man is a real fighting hero, a .45-caliber slug placed in such a spot brings him down as though he were struck over the head with a club, and having fallen, he forgets all about fighting. He feels that he is bleeding to death and shouts for help. Such shouts rose now. 3 men were down, one pitching back upon a dice table and involving it in the ruin of his fall. Footsteps sounded heavily on the floor, footsteps that retreated from Weldon.
Then all the lights went out. The place was pitch black. But in it, like three flashing lights, were the repeated voices of men calling out in fear and agony. Weldon rose to his knees and reloaded his weapons. Then he stood up and walked for the rear of the big room. As he stepped, the little golden spurs chinked and chimed sweetly on his heels, and yet he moved with as much certainty as though he were a stalking cat in the midst of that blackness. The authorities would be there at once. It was only strange that they did not come sooner, unless they wanted to give the men of Cabrero an ample chance to finish this little business for themselves. His hand touched the long, cold, smoothly polished bar. At the same time, a faint glow, like fire, ran along it. The front door had been opened, and men with strong lights were entering. Weldon ran down the bar, leaped over it, and passed through the door beyond. He ran through a dense crowd, also standing in darkness. "The Americano?" someone asked him. "The police will have him. He's wounded and can't run," Weldon answered. He added, "Where is the room of Señor Cabrero? I know the name of this gringo. I want to tell him."
"Ah, it will warm his heart to know that. Come, come."
The man took him actually by the hand and led him through a dark passage. They reached a door, neatly rimmed around with light.
"Here!"
He tapped three times, paused, and tapped again.
"Enter!"
Weldon turned the knob, stepped through, and closed the door quickly behind him. Chapter 6 Outside the door, however, willing to be known for his zealous services, the voice of a man was calling,
"Señor, señor, I, Pedro, have brought you this man. He knows the name of the gringo."
"That is well," Cabrero said.
Weldon bowed to him. Cabrero was patting the top of his desk with a fat hand that, when it was spread out flat, had little dimples over the top of each knuckle. Once he had been very small and delicately made, no doubt. As a boy, he must have been a beautiful creature, but he had begun to overflow. His cheeks were round and tight with fat. His eyes were so pouched by it that, when he smiled, they disappeared. Between each button of his waistcoat there was a bulge, and the upper sleeve of his coat was as tight as a sausage. He was so full of curves, and his color was so high, that he looked rather like a strangely shaped balloon that had just been blown up hard.
"You know this American? You yourself are an American?"
"Ah, yes," said Weldon. "The name of that man is Weldon."
"Why,"
said the head of the gaming house, smoothing one hand with another,
"do you come to tell me about the name of this countryman of yours? Is he an enemy?"
There was much noise and shouting, dim in the distance, behind thick walls.
"Not publicly," Weldon said, "but privately, he has done me a great deal of harm."
Cabrero still smoothed his hand.
"I don't understand that," he said. "But I do understand that you want something done to this man?"
"Yes, I do."
"Then if he escapes, where shall I find him?" asked Cabrero.
"But how can he escape from the whole police force of this city?"
"It has been done," Cabrero said.
His eyes disappeared, but not with a smile.
"I have very little time. I am very busy. Where shall I find this man?"
"Here," said Weldon.
"Still in my house?"
"Yes."
"Where in it?"
"Here," repeated Weldon. Cabrero opened both his eyes. The lids had to struggle against the incumbent fat.
"Dios,"
he said under his breath. "I am Weldon," the American explained gently. "I won 4,000 at your wheel, honestly. I lost the 4,000 and another 1,000 on top of that. You have a safe behind you." Cabrero turned gray. He did not answer. A hand beat on the door.
"Señor, señor, the American, the pig dog, he is gone!"
Weldon smiled.
"Be gone, fool!"
Cabrero cried. Footfalls retreated.
"Don't hesitate," said Weldon. "I told you what to do." Steadily, his eyes as unblinking as those of a snake,